Day four on the Millivay stage. We will have now a talk about hacking commercial drones. I want to introduce to you Felix Domke with his talk, WTF DJI UAV CTF, a hacker's view at commercial drone security.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for coming. I'm Felix Domke. You may know me before here from here. I talked about gaming console security, about reversing digital emission cheats a while ago. Today, I'm talking about something else. Today, I talk about drones, specifically DJI drones. Drones are cool tech, I guess. Relatively advanced tech, consumer things. You can easily buy them. They're, I think, cool. But I'm not good at flying, and I really prefer a nice game of CTF, so why not have both? Looking at DJI drones, DJI is kind of the 70% market share leader, so if you buy your random drone in a shop, then the chances are pretty good it's a DJI drone. There are a few other vendors, but DJI kind of has the highest market share. I looked at them and figured out they are really cool hardware CTFs if you look at them this way. They look like a drone, but there is really a lot of fun to be had hacking them, right? Talking with ordinary people, you tell them, hey, I like to hack drones, and what they ask is typically, why would you hack a drone? And it's not a question I need to explain to you, right? But other people need a reason to hack something, so I collected a few reasons why people may be interested in hacking drones. It gives a good overview, actually, of why there is any security at all in these devices. Because you can think, well, like, why do they need any security? It's about the hardware, and they don't need security. But that's actually wrong. And the reason is that drones are not like ordinary consumer tech. A drone easily allows a consumer to commit crimes, right? If you fly over the wrong areas, if you fly over a prison, if you fly into something, there's a lot of stupid things you can do, and there are a lot of stupid consumers, so that's not a great mix. And security is, that's the idea here, to help you. What drones need to do these days, commercial drones that like customers can buy, that are not rules if you build your own quadcopter, by the way. You can still do that, and nobody stops you from doing it. But if you want to sell a drone, it better gets certified, because you get certain advantages from being certified. And if you want to get certified, it means you have to implement several safety measures. And as we see, these safety measures essentially require security measures to not get easily circumvented. One of these safety measures are called no-fly zones. It's kind of obvious what they are. It's a geodatabase. It's basically a huge list of polygons that ship with the drones. If the drone detects you're getting near such a polygon, let's say over a prison, over an airport, over other areas, the drone will prevent you from going there. And you can kind of opt out of that mechanism by applying for an unlock on the DJI website, and they need you to fill out all kind of stuff, give you, like, put in documentation that you're allowed there. And then you can ask for unlocking such a no-fly zone. Essentially, what happens is that DJI throws all your documentation away and approves it anyway. But the idea is that there is a paper trail of when you want to fly in these areas. And so that's one reason why drones need security. Going more into the certification, and I won't bore you with the details, but basically the European Union, and it's very similar in different other parts of the world, have a certification program, and you can get a drone certified for a certain class. And one example is the C1 class, and there are several rules for C1. Basically, you have to have a maximum takeoff weight, you need to have a maximum flight speed, and you need to have collision avoidance sensors and several stuff like that. And if you can prove you have all of that, you get certified. You get certified to a certain drone class, and that gives you the benefits as the user, because it allows you to fly under slightly different rules than if a drone would be unclassified. It also depends on a lot of other stuff that I won't go into. So there's a huge incentive here for the vendors of these drones to get the drones certified, because they can sell more, right? And there are fewer restrictions. And also, like, drone manufacturers really don't like bad news. So if there's news again how someone flew over an airport or something, that's bad for the drone manufacturers. So they want to avoid that by enforcing these limitations. One interesting aspect here is that to get certified these days, you also need a there's a requirement for transmitting an ID. And there are several technologies here that have converged to something that's either Bluetooth or Wi-Fi based. There are, however, also legacy standards, specifically from DJI, and one of them I will talk about later, which is called Drone ID. The other official standards are called Remote ID. It's basically the same kind of data that's transmitted, just over different interface or different RF technologies. And you need to implement this in your drone, otherwise you don't get certified. So all of these things would be useless if someone can just flash an unlocked firmware to it. And that's the reason why there's actually a pretty good deal of security in these drones. And if there's a pretty good deal of security, then it makes a pretty good CTF, right? So that was kind of my approach here. There are also different aspects here. So as I said, broadcasting the location is mandatory for drones. But that has created a lot of problem in the Ukrainian war when they flew with commercial drones to just to like get pictures, and they were easily trackable with their pilot location, and they get attacked by just using drones. So that is obviously the downside of this technology. In this case, if the Ukrainians are using these drones, so there's a large demand to circumvent these technologies. But either way, let's make this a CTF. Intro 100 is unboxing. What's in the package? In the package is this, basically. It's the DJI Mini 2 in this case. Internal code name is WM161. That's how they name their devices. If we open it up, of course, then we look at this. It's the underside of the drone. There's the controller board. There's also a different controller board, the power board on the top that has the motor controllers and the battery connection. And there's the camera, the gimbal on the left, that is basically a three-axis movable camera to isolate from vibrations during the flight. And then like these arms unfold, and then there are the motors on these arms. Taking a closer look at the PCB, this is the PCB. We can see that there's a big chip here. It's an Ambarella H22. Ambarella is a chip that's used in many action cams. It's a camera chip, so it has a few Cortex-A cores, runs Linux, runs some RTOS, where they do the image processing side by side to Linux. It's well known from other action cams, actually. It's used here in a drone to process the video input from the main camera, which can be up to 4K. And then the Ambarella chip has also the video encoders and writes it to SD card and sends the encoded stream over the RF link. And there's also DRAM to it, so the thing has a lot of DRAM to run Linux and do all the image processing there. There's a few headers here on the left that connect to other stuff. In the middle, we see the RF portion. There is the so-called DJI S1 chip. That's actually a custom silicon that DJI has built for their drones. DJI has started using commodity silicon, and starting in 2017 or something, they replaced more and more of their chips with actual custom ASICs. They have the unit number, so this makes a lot of sense for them. And they implement an RF protocol that's proprietary to DJI, that's called OcuSync. There are different versions of it, but they all are relatively similar. I'll talk about this later a bit, but it's essentially kind of LTE-based or has similarities with LTE, so they basically took an LTE standard, removed everything they didn't like, and then added their own stuff to it. There's a debug header, unpopulated debug header on the top right that we will also talk about. There are two time-of-flight sensors, or one time-of-flight LED and a sensor to measure the distance to the ground. And there's also in the middle, there's a, sorry, in the middle, there's a QVGA, so a 160 to 120 small image sensor that they used to detect drifting so they can stabilize even if the GPS position isn't great. So that there's some machine vision involved here as well. Looking at this at the other side, we see that there is another big chip, the IMX-RT1064. It's a microcontroller, a pretty heavy microcontroller from the IMX-RT series. RT stands for real time. So this is where the real time stuff happens. This is where the flight controller runs, that controls the motors, that sends us the IMU inputs. Basically, the Linux can crash. You can reboot the Linux in flight, and it will not crash because the flight controller keeps the thing flying. So that's the idea here. So it runs a lot of high-rate real-time tasks at 1 kilohertz, sometimes more than 1 kilohertz, to process the IMU input, but also does a lot of other stuff, specifically, as we will see, also some part of the security here. The no-flight zones, for example, are implemented as a mix in the flight controller and the Linux side. So the flight controller basically tracks keeps track of the position and then eventually streams the no-flight zone database, which is relatively large, several 10 megabytes, to the flight controller, so the flight controller can do the decisions on if flying is allowed or not. What we also see here is, a Wi-Fi chip. Wi-Fi in this drone is mostly used for transferring pictures and videos off the drone. It's not used on this drone for control. And there is the more DRAM and the NAND flash for the Ambarella Linux chip. And NAND flash, what do? With NAND flashes? We desolder them and dump them. So that's what I did. I bought a water-damaged board from eBay for a couple of euro and desoldered the NAND flash, dumped the NAND flash. And if we look at the NAND flash, surprisingly, we see something that does not look totally encrypted, which is surprising, maybe. If we disassemble it, yay, it's ARM code. So definitely, there's at least the bootloader here is not encrypted. But there's more we can find in the NAND flash. So let's do a forensics challenge. There's a file called blame image, and I will show you what it means. First thing, if we look at the data that's on a drone, even if you buy a drone on eBay, if you find a broken drone in the woods or something, there are flight logs on them. They store the logs of the last 10, 20, depending on the duration, flights. It's several hundred megabytes per flight. It's a lot of data where all the sensor data is, all the position data, everything. And it allows you to reconstruct the flight. So I bought a random water damaged drone on eBay, and this is what I extracted. So someone made a photos in some public space here. Keep that in mind when buying or selling drones. But there are also some images stored here. There are no images stored from the main cameras, and this is maybe hard to see here, but those are images from the downvision sensor, from the, it's 160 by 120, so pretty low resolution, it's just black and white. But you can see how someone flew over some house or something. And interestingly, if you get a factory fresh drone, you can find images from the factory in it. So you see some kind of a testing machine or something, and probably someone holding it upwards. But let's go back to the code, to the secure boot thing. And if we look at it closer, we see some standard Ambarella stuff. So we see this small bootstrap loader, 800 bytes, that just does the minimum to fetch the next stage, which is a bootloader stage called mBoot, which is comes with the Ambarella chip from the company that builds the chip. In theory, it has a console, but on the DJI drone, the console path is not reachable. Instead, what they jump to is LDR1, and LDR1 is the first code that's written by DJI. And if we look at that code, which is still plain text, we see that there's a UART you need. It receives some keys over the UART, and then it loads a compressed and encrypted kernel. So if we look at a little bit more details, we see that the UART is initialized at 1.5 megabit standard stuff otherwise. We see that there are packets sent over that look somehow like this. There's a 55 in the beginning. There are some fields. That's basically what we get from disassembling that loader. And in the end, there's a CSC, and there are some magic numbers here that are commands, and those we would expect to see on that UART. And then if we look at the thing that loads the compressed kernel, actually, this is where kind of the secure boot really starts, because now everything is encrypted and signed. This is also the, how updates are delivered to these drones. They are encrypted and signed. That plain text stuff is just written on it in the factory and never rewritten. Everything that's getting that's updated is signed. So the idea is it's kind of a ROM, except it's not really a ROM. And then all the volatile stuff, or all the stuff that can be changed, is actually properly encrypted and signed. And of course, we're interested in decrypting these things. So let's see where that key comes from. Because the key that they use there is something that they received over the UART in an encrypted form. So if we look at further down in the flash and the NAND flash, we see these encrypted packages. Basically, we see this header that we expected from the parser code. We see there's an RTOS partition. We see that there's a key used called TBIE, whatever that means, and there's a signature on the bottom, and there's a another key identifier for the key that's used to verify the signature. So this looks relatively sane at this point, but we want the key, we want to decrypt this. So what we do is we can sniff the UART where they receive the encrypted keys. There's an additional encryption layer, so the keys don't go plain text over this layer. We remember there was 1.5 megabit. We remember there was something like 55 something. So if we probe and random portions on the board, we expect to eventually see that. I removed the flight controller here, tracked down the pins from the package, and eventually found some promising pin, the UART, and a receive and transmit pins. There are multiple UARTs on that. One of them, indeed, if we sniff there, we see some data. And the data, if we look closer, has exactly what we're looking for. It has this 01C3, which I guess is the identification of where this goes. We see 40.22.28, which is the command set and ID, so some identifier. And we see the encrypted key. And unfortunately, it's encrypted. But at least we know the same data that goes into this bootloader. Armed with that knowledge, let's take a look at how this is actually encrypted. We can see from disassembling it, it's a symmetric CMAC. Yeah. So the key to decrypt this UART packet must be in the LDR1, which we know is plain text, which we can disassemble. So we should have all the information to decrypt this, get the key, and then take a look at the next firmware stages. So the question is, where does that key come from? Further disassembly shows, oh, it's a white boxed AES implementation. So there's a lot of obfuscation going on. They try to hide this key by making it difficult to extract it using something called white box scheme, where basically you obfuscate your code enough to hope that the hacker can't undo that. I'm not in the mood to undo that, so I just wrote a few lines of Unicorn code to emulate that code and eventually extract that key. So it's just ARM code, so the obfuscation doesn't really matter as long as we get the key in the end. Armed with that knowledge, we can now extract the keys that are used for the software for the software updates. We get this TBIE key. We get also the UFIE key, which is the key to encrypt software updates that you can download from the internet. If you download a firmware for the Mini 2, it's all encrypted with this key. So with this key, we can now go take a look at our encrypted RTOS again. And yay, we can decrypt it. So we got the RTOS. The RTOS is in charge for doing the machine vision. It does the drift camera thing. The RTOS also does the main camera video encoding. It runs on this Umbrella core in a kind of AMP setup. So there's Linux running and there's the RTOS running side by side. They both have dedicated memory and dedicated peripherals. So for example, there are two USB controllers. One belongs to Linux, one belongs to the RTOS, and they can both do their thing on different USB ports and not interfere with each other. We can go further and we see a different blob. And I know this is hard to read, but there's a blob that says Linux. So can Linux fly? We decrypt it, and so we see, yeah, there's Linux, some older version, obviously, built with an old toolchain, built, well, at least in a CI build. It's not built on a developer machine, so yay. Linux, I mean, is GPL, so let's download the source code. So there's opensource.dji.com, and there is a section for open source software on Umbrella platform, so let's download it, and we download it. And it's 0 bytes. And it hasn't been updated in ages. And they don't respond to emails. So GPL violation, yeah. They also don't put anything about the GPL in the package, no written offer, no nothing. They don't acknowledge that they're using Linux. And that's, by the way, true for all their devices. They are all Linux-based, and they knowingly do nothing, which is kind of unfortunate. And they still sell their stuff all around the world, including Germany. So I would really like them to see them to be more compliant. If someone wants to work on that, please let me know. Okay, so we're back to disassembling. One interesting thing we saw in these initial messages where we saw the keys being downloaded from the flight controller, we also see a final message that we didn't know what it was, but if we trace it down further, we see that the result of that encrypted message is eventually fed into the kernel command line as an argument to secure debug. So if that value is zero, then secure debug will be set to zero, and if it's one, then, well, it's one. And then there are some scripts in the root file system that would open up ADB, so the Android debug bridge, so you can execute shell commands as root, if that secure debug would be one, but it's zero in our case. So let's take a look where this comes from and whether we can do something about it. So next stop is we look into the flight controller. Again, the flight controller does all the flying. It does not need Linux to boot even, so you can fly the drone without Linux, but then you don't get the camera working and things like that, but you still get a flying drone. It's an IMX RT1064, which is a somewhat new IMX series, Cortex-M7, relatively quick, that comes with either external or internal flash. On the Mini 1, they used external flash, a WinBond 2 MB chip. On the Mini 2, they used the another variant of the IMX RT that has the flash integrated. It's literally the same flash die, just integrated into the package. But for hacking purposes, I wanted to look at the Mini 1 because I can easily dump the flash and then maybe apply that to the Mini 2. And if we look at the flash, we can see that it's encrypted. But we can also see that it executes directly from it. And this is possible because the IMX RT has a mode called BEE, Bus Encryption Engine, where basically on the fly, when the CPU is reading from the address space that resembles the flash, it will pull that in over spy flash, it will decrypt it with an integrated key that comes from OTP eFuses, and will present the decrypted version to the CPU. And this is how they can do execute in place out of an encrypted flash. Obviously, we want the plain text. One interesting observation here is, while, yeah, it's all encrypted, we also see that repeated blocks encrypt to the same thing. And that kind of makes sense, because the problem you have for a bus decryption, an inline bus decryption, is always that it's random access. The CPU can jump anywhere, and you need to be able to decrypt that block with really low latency, because the CPU is stalled while you do this. So you can't really use like CBC with a large block size or something, because it would require you to read a lot of data before you can actually decrypt what the CPU is looking for. So they circumvented all of that. They could use like maybe counter mode or other things, but counter mode plus authentication or something, but they didn't. It's plain AES ECB. And so I guess you all know the false colored penguin. This is a crocodile, and we are afraid of crocodiles, so we encrypt the crocodile with ECB, so there's no crocodile anymore, right? It's encrypted. I mean, what happens here, that each 16 bytes are encrypted on their own, so essentially it's just it just creates false colors with basically the same data. That's the core problem with encrypting ECB data, is that you can still infer a lot of structure. But worse, there's no authentication. We can mix and match stuff. So when the flight controller boots, we can see that it does some serial output, like it outputs some init something. It at some point stops then, but there's some serial output. And we can take a look at what happens on the spy flash while that is executing. And what we expect to happen here is that there is some CPU code fetched from the flash, that is the printf, and then we expect the string to be fetched from spy flash and getting decrypted and then exposed to the CPU. So if we just randomly mess with different portions of the flash, and we can be a bit more clever than random, but random works as well, eventually what we observe is if we patch at a certain location, just like put zeros in there or something, we see that string change. And what it changes to is the decrypted version of what we put into, because originally it was the string, now it's whatever we put in there. So we have an oracle. We can put anything we want to decrypt at that location, and the printf will happily output that. It will read from flash, it will read our manipulated data, it will decrypt our manipulated data, and we can take it from everywhere because it's ECB. Like, the address is not included in the encryption. The encryption is the same for every address. And we can put it there, and we get it well until the first zero byte, actually, which is a bit annoying, but still better than nothing. And so that gives us an ability to peek into the encrypted space. There's, if you look closer, the way it works on this IMXRT CPU, which, by the way, has a perfectly working secure boot architecture that just isn't used here. You see that there is actually a table that defines which region of flash are encrypted, and that is, that region is encrypted not with the flash encryption key, but with a different key, and that key is stored in flash encrypted, so it's a double encryption. But we can use our oracle to decrypt that. So at the flash header, we have this unknown encrypted key. We put it in the location that we know was the string. We make it boot. It outputs that thing, and it would output the key. And we see it outputs nothing because the first byte is a zero. And like just trying, all the other bytes are zero. So that means they put an all zero key there. So to be clear, this is not the key that encrypts the flash. This is just the key that encrypts this table at the beginning of the flash. But it's all zero. So we can take that data, we decrypt it with the all zero key, and we see this data. And this data actually has two important things in it, because it stores the start and the end of the encrypted area. Everything outside that area is not encrypted on the fly. Everything in that area is decrypted on the fly with this unknown key. So we can patch that. We make it from 2,000 to 3,000. And then we put some unencrypted dumper code that we can just write that reads from the encrypted area and puts it on the serial port where we can read it. So we have a much better oracle now. We can dump the complete firmware and are not limited by zero bytes anymore. And we can basically circumvent this BEE, this bust on the fly decryption. The BEE, I'm not sure if you can use it really securely. It's a silicon feature, obviously, that someone put a lot of thought into. I think if you use it together with secure boot and you use that mode where it reads the program from the flash into the RAM and decrypts it on the fly and then verifies the signature with the secure boot, then you may be able to use this. But the way how DJI used it is definitely not secure and just stupid. Okay, we now have the flight controller code. We can disassemble it. We can look at how they implement all things like no-fly zones and whatever. But in this case, we're interested in getting root on the Linux device for whatever, but we want to get root, right? So we look at this secure debug mode. And to make it short, what happens is that they use CMEC and they use a memcompare. And the idea with CMEC is that it's a secret value that gets compared with a value provided from the outside. So if you just use memcompare, there's a huge timing leak in there. You can try byte by byte and look at the timing. And every time it compares, it stops comparing after the first wrong byte. So if you measure the time and the time gets longer, you know that you guessed one byte correctly. And then you can guess one byte at a time. So one thing, but it gets much easier because the key is just in there and the key is just hard-coded in the firmware. So with that key, we can talk with the flight controller and convince the flight controller to enable secure debug. And on the next boot then, when Linux boots, it observes that and enables ADB, and then you get a root shell, which is nice. But it gets even easier. This is the debug header that I previously shown, and I mean, it's unpopulated, there's no header on it, but apparently it's used in internal development or maybe recovery of drones or something. And there's one pin that directly goes to the umbrella chip, and I don't know what the proper name is, but I call it USB boot, because if you pull that pin to 3.3 volt, what you observe is that the next time you plug in USB to the drone, you're not getting the typical like DJI USB gadget that gives you most mesh storage mostly, and ADB. Instead, you get this thing, which is the Umbrella bootloader. It's a very basic bootloader. You can dump the boot ROM. If you have root on Linux, you can just dump it. And it's a 512 bytes bootloader, and they implement USB, so they implement a very bare minimum USB thing, where basically all you can do is read descriptors and do a control transfer to read, write, or call an address. And there's some Umbrella Windows tool that allows you to reflash devices with that. It doesn't work for us because the NAND is different, the DRAM is different, and so on. But we can write our own code. We can use this scheme. We can upload some USB handler that initializes DRAM, NAND flash, has a USB stack. And then we can use this to read and write NAND flash. And we can rewrite LDR1, remove the signature checks, and we can rewrite the kernel rootfs. We get full control over the Linux portion of it. Linux portion is great, but what about the flight controller? We got you covered there as well. IMSRT has, like all other IMX chips, some method of booting over USB. It's called SDP, Serial Download Protocol, which these days is USB and not serial anymore. It can also run over a serial port. And there are NXP tools to do that. It's what you'd use in development all the time. And typically, you would configure your chip to use secure boot and disable that and not make this available. And it's perfectly supported from NXP, but DJI didn't do it. So we can use SDP. Turns out the two boot pins are exposed on this debug header as well. If you pull them into the right direction, it will go to this USB boot mode. It's a different USB header, so the main USB port goes to the Umbrella chip, so you actually have to wire up D plus and D minus here as well. But then you can use the official tools to reflash the flight controller. It still does not give you the encryption key, so you need to flash an encrypted image. So it doesn't, you cannot flash anything you want, but combined with the previous exploits with the Oracle, you can re-encrypt your favorite code and run it. So we can also use this to write arbitrary code to the flight controller, which means we now control all the code that's in charge of flying the drone, making pictures, and so on. And we could put cool stuff there. I don't know what, but that was the goal, right? So we can see a lot of other funny things. So this is how DJI does stuff. They love to use popen in system. And here they try to remove some files, and they literally, if you can't read this, do this by doing a popen busybox find / black box, reading it line by line, and then calling system rm %s with the file name, which is obviously cool because it gives you a lot of shell injection methods. I think this is fixed, and the way they fixed it is by adding a regular expression that tries to filter the file names before sending it to rm %s. And they typically forget some special characters, because honestly, filtering shell input with a regular expression is really hard, and you shouldn't do that. That's all I have on the drone, but let's take a look at the RF layer a little bit. Again, it's called OcuSync. OcuSync exists in multiple versions that are basically similar-ish and only differ in parameters. If we look at an RF spectrum of a drone flying, then we see this pattern. And again, hard to see, but you see like these big fat bars at the top. That's the downlink. Left to right is time, up to down is frequency. So we see a 20 megahertz downlink channel, and we see a 1.4 megahertz uplink channel that is frequency hopping. And we can put this into a nice framing where every 10 milliseconds this pattern repeats. Every 10 milliseconds there is a new hopping frequency for the uplink. So this is similar-ish to LTE. If we look closer, we look at a 10 millisecond frame. We can see that there are sub-slots, and each 1 millisecond slot is either occupied by a downlink signal or by nothing, or by an uplink signal. And then some of these downlink symbols are frames are special because they allow you to synchronize with it. That's why they look so funny in the spectrum in the middle. But one interesting thing is that every 640 milliseconds, we see, and this is again very hard to see, we see some one more thing in an otherwise unused slot. This is this 10 megahertz thing at the bottom that happens to be before one of the uplink slots, And again, every 640 milliseconds on a different frequency, the drone transmits this 10 megahertz signal. If we look at this closer, we can see that this is OFDM symbols. There are, in this case, 9 OFDM symbols. The two symbols look funny, so they are special synchronization symbols. The other are data symbols. And if we do some magic that where we roughly know how to do it, where we have a proof of concept, but we hope to get this fully automated and running in real time, then you get a QPSK constellation where you can see the individual bits. And if you assemble the bits together and then run it through some error correction, that is all, I mean, scrambling, that is also LTE-like, but not quite LTE, then what we see a frame that looks like this, and it includes the drone serial number, it includes the pilot location as a GPS position, and the drone location and attitude and speed. So this is the how they built this drone ID, which again is this legacy standard, not the new one that uses Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, they're converting to that, but all DJI drones since 2017 or something transmit this signal regardless of where you fly, and it can be picked up in up to, well, DJI sells a device called Aeroscope that allows you to pick up these beacons. They initially claimed it was encrypted, but as we've seen, it's not encrypted. And they basically sell you this device for quite a lot of money and can be used by airport operators or other people to identify drones that are flying around. And apparently with the right antennas, it gets you like 30 kilometers of range or something. That's all I had for now. This is a small part of the whole DJI ecosystem. DJI builds a lot of drones with other technologies like their own silicon. They build other devices. It's a huge company. They also build non-drone stuff. They build action cameras. They build commercial video tools that also use video transmission using the same OcuSync standard. So they try to use their technology in all kind of different ways. There's a branch of DJI that does car integration. They built a cleaning robot, like a Roomba or something. They built all kind of stuff. I think in here in Europe, we only see a fraction of that, but they expand more and more and keep reusing the technologies. Their custom silicon, for example, is used in many of these other devices. We are out of time for now. I can hopefully still take some questions, if I'm allowed. Yeah. But
we still have 10 minutes. So if you have questions, please line up at the microphone. Felix will answer your questions now.
Hi, yeah, thanks. What do you think about remote ID in general? And what do you think, remote ID related to non-drone drones? So basically airplanes or helicopters.
The standard collision avoidance scheme for drones and airplanes is separation by enforcing maximum height and so on. And then for the larger drones, they need to observe ADS-B traffic, so basically the beacons from the planes, and then do avoidance maneuvers. Remote ID, I think, is less useful for planes avoiding drones. Also for the fact that planes can't really do a lot to avoid a drone because a drone is so much quicker to navigate. So it should always be on the burden of the drone to do evasive actions. I think the idea of remote ID is more that air is a shared space. Even if you own the ground, air is still a shared space. So it comes with responsibilities to use it. It's kind of a non-saying answer because it's a obviously hugely political thing. I believe for non-conflict areas, it is a good thing if there's responsibility by people who fly drones. And responsibility, unfortunately, these days means that you can see what people are doing. If we find a different solution to that, that would be great. But currently, the only feasible solution I see is making people aware of where drones are simply to keep the pilots responsible. But I would be happy to see a better solution.
Do you think other manufacturers doing same stuff like the DJI drones?
Yeah, they're so they are not that far off, both in what they do in terms of using Linux and then using some real-time stuff, also in kind of what security holes they have. Obviously, there's a whole world of non-consumer drones and military drones that I haven't looked into at all and don't plan to. So things may be different there, but for consumer drones, it's roughly similar in how they do things and what quality they do things.
You talked about the drone ID, and there was one thing I couldn't quite pick up. You said something about 2017, and is this drone ID used since 2017, or is it not used since 2017? So has there been a new version? If there is a new version, did anybody peek into it? How is this secured? Because just seeing the pilot's location can lead to some security implications, as the YouTube video you showed has shown.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Talks about mandatory remote ID have been there since basically consumer drones exist. DJI tried to get ahead of the game by implementing their own proprietary scheme, kind of voluntarily doing this since 2017. They had some different schemes before, but basically they consistently implemented this since roughly that time frame. And this is also when they started selling this device that picks them up. But this was all because there was no official standard based on proprietary DJI things. Back then, you could flip a switch in your app to disable that. That doesn't work anymore. But back then, it was voluntary, so that's how this got implemented. During these times, standardization has happened, and there are now X plus one standards. So there's now a Japanese standard, there's a European standard, there's a US standard. They differ in some things, they are similar in some things, but what they have all common is that they're not built on proprietary technologies like OcuSync, but using Bluetooth and Wi-Fi frames, thereby heavily restricting the range of these things. So it doesn't work well, or the design goal for these official remote ID implementations was several kilometers of range. The design goal for OcuSync is 30 kilometers of range, which is a huge difference. DJI, I guess, currently they added Remote ID, the official one, to all their drones, even old drones. I'm not sure if they will do this eventually instead of what the OcuSync version, but currently they do both.
Thank you, Felix Domke.
Yeah, thank you.